This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you everyone for coming and thank you for your patience. I would, of course, first like to acknowledge the Ngambri and Ngunnawal peoples as the traditional owners of the Canberra region. They are consistent contributors to the museum's cultural life and we're very, very grateful for their continued assistance. Now, this forum has been organised to celebrate the Indigenous activists of the 1920s and 30s. And it's a particularly suitable year, being the anniversary of the 1938 Day of Mourning, which initiated in Sydney. The people we are celebrating here are those well-known figures from the time, Fred Maynard, William Cooper, Jack Patton, and the less well-known activists, such as Jack Tattersall, who was part of the Day of Mourning group and who also worked for the improvement of conditions on Coomadichie Mission, Port Kembla, where he lived. For this celebration, we are privileged to have with us here today some people who have had a very personal connection with that time in history. In particular, we welcome Auntie Esther Carroll, Auntie Ollie Campbell, and do we have Liz Campbell here? I think. No, it didn't arrive. Auntie Esther and Auntie Ollie were actually there at the event on the day of mourning, and we have their photographs in the hall, I think, over there as well. Professor John Maynard is the grandson of Fred Maynard. Diane O'Brien and her sister Barbara are the descendants of both William Cooper and Jack Patton. Susan Ingram's family was also very closely involved with the Day of Mourning organisation. And Barbara Nicholson is the daughter of Jack Tattersall. We'll be leaving them, I'll be leaving them, to tell their own stories and their own experiences and also the stories of their own lives. As well as our distinguished visitors and guests, you'll notice these objects we have from the museum collection. We have a boomerang in the case, which belonged to Jack Tattersall and which his daughter Barbara has generously donated to the museum. We also have a protest banner, the Australian Aborigines League, which has survived from the times. Most banners don't survive the event. This one did. And it becomes an icon for what happened then and what's followed subsequently. The banner was produced by Bill Onus, another participant in the Day of Mourning and a lifelong fighter for Indigenous rights. The banner was presented to the museum by Gary Foley, another well-known Indigenous fighter and activist. And lastly, we have the painting by Bill Onus's son. This is also from our museum collections and certainly tells a powerful story and puts activists into a familiar context. The role of the police in the removal of people from homes at the time lingers in history. I think just before proceeding, the significance of this event is Australia is emerging from what I think is a small ice age, which has lasted roughly 11 or 12 years, in which attempts were made to hide history. And what we are learning, what has happened is the stories have not been suffocated. We have learnt through this time that history affects lives of people today. It's not frozen in time. Everyone's lives have been affected by the events of the Day of Mourning, the protest movement, civil rights, the 1967 referendum. These activities in history have shaped our lives and will shape our lives and will shape the lives of our children. In particular, they have shaped the lives of the people who are here today. And we thank them for their willingness to be here and to share their stories with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for that kind introduction. As a Wurimi man from the Port Stephens area just north of Newcastle, I would also like to pay my respects to the traditional custodians, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and their ancestral lands, within which we're most honoured to be a visitor. Oop, I've pressed a button. And also pay respects to our elders past and present. I just like to also begin to say that, look, as an individual, I'm sure I can speak for the other peoples on the panel, that I'm most honoured to be here and take part in this, which I see as a most significant event, and I really pay my respects to the National Museum for organising, in particular Jay Arthur and Troy Pickwick. Where is he? Hiding somewhere? For the invitation to come down And as I said, which is to me a most significant event to honour the memory of some very legendary, what I would say, Aboriginal pioneer activists who were brave and courageous at a completely different time to what we've got now. Although certainly the position that Aboriginal people find themselves in today, I mean, we've still got a great fight and struggle that goes on. And the comment that we've come out of a bit of an ice age, I'm still a bit brushing the ice off for the last 11 and a half, 12 years, I have to tell you. It's been a pretty frozen time as far as Indigenous history. I think there was no doubt that there was a process of taking Australian history basically back to the 1950s and certainly glorifying the history of that time period, glorifying the history of the settlers, the discoverers and the pioneers, etc. And an Aboriginal place in that history was sort of pushed onto the back agenda. We have, so fortunately today, I mean, to have such a number of the descendants here and of people like William Cooper and Bill Ferguson and Jack Patton and, of course, Jack Tattersall and myself with my grandfather, Fred Maynard. It's not just going to be us talking about our ancestors in the sense of also what they fought for. I'm sure that will be a part of it, and we're very passionate about that, and I'm sure we'll be able to express that. But I think it's also importantly about what that means to us as individuals, what it has meant to us as regards to our families, what it has meant to us as regards to our communities, and certainly what it has meant to us in a sense of the Aboriginal nation as a whole, because it's the inspiration of these people and what they stood for and what they still stand for, which is the force that we carry. Certainly what I've done, whether it's in academia or how I conduct myself in the public or in private, has a lot to do with the memory of my grandfather and what he stood for and the respect that his name actually carries. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of the other descendants in that regard. Our first discussion, I think, is in regards to Bill Ferguson. It's going to be talked about by Auntie June Barker. Auntie June online somewhere?
Yes.
Ah, there she is. How are you, Aunt?
Yeah, I'm really good.
All right, it's great to have you with us. And,
yeah, thank you.
As you would have heard, I said that I'm sure you're going to give us insights into your grandfather, Bill Ferguson, and your memories of him and certainly the importance and role that he played in early Aboriginal political activism, but also how it impacted onto you and your family and community and, as I said, the wider community. Would you like to give us, open up the discussion in regards to, in the memories of Bill Ferguson?
Well, first I'd like to say how brave they must have been back in those days to speak up and stand out against the white Australians. Sitting here now today and listening to the words that have been said down there, it takes you back. You get the feeling in my heart and in my chest that that's how they must have felt on that day when Australia celebrated the 150th anniversary. Our people in the Australian Hall, they had nothing to celebrate. They called it a day of mourning. And I've looked at the post of the photo of the children there standing in front, and I all throughout my life I knew what it was all about. I knew why my grandfather went down to the board meetings down to Bridge Street. I now know why there used to be always Aborigines coming to where they lived in Dubbo at number 1 Wingiwara Street. He'd be sitting there writing letters. I know now they must have been letters of complaint that he was taken down to put before the board. The soldiers that came, that was stationed there in Dubbo, they came there and they came from all over Australia, and they'd spend some time there with my grandfather. When he'd go to the board meetings, we'd run across to the railway station to wave to him, because we knew that, you know, he was going down to the board meetings. All throughout my childhood, that was all that I knew about, even though I lived on the Brewarrina Mission with my parents. I knew what was taking place. Like, I think it was in the 1938, I would have been only very small. But Roy, my husband, he's got a good memory, and he remembers the day when Bill Ferguson came to the mission to hold meetings there with the Brewarrina mission people, and the manager hunted them off the station, the mission station. They all walked off, women and children and the men, to get off the government Aborigines protection land, to get out through the gates, and they held a meeting there. The kids gathered lots of wood and they made a big fire and everyone sat around while he had the meeting there. Many years after that, I was a girl, I guess about 12 or 13, in Dubbo, if you know Dubbo. The swimming pool is there, not far from the railway station. And there used to be a little, they called it the Railway Institute Hall. And with a cousin of mine, we were walking past. We seen all the Aborigines there in Dubbo. They're called the Maing, the Murrays. And I could see straight into the hall. And this picture has stayed with me all throughout my life. We heard the loud voice. I knew it was my grandfather's voice. And we stood and looked. And we could see straight into the hall. And I can still see him standing there out the front of the hall, inside the hall, and speaking. And the loud voice that came out of that hall, loud and clear, with no microphones or anything back in those days. And I know that he did have a loud, clear voice. But that's one picture, one memory that I've carried all through my life of my grandfather. Also, living in Brewarrina there at the mission, everything was, my childhood, was all about the struggles, how the mission managers, how he'd be saying, they're woeful people, you know, we've got to get rid of them. They've got no sympathy towards our Aboriginal people. And later on in my life, I understood all that. I just knew how humiliating, how degrading, how all these feelings were to be living on a mission with a manager over you. Men that weren't very nice people. People that wouldn't let our Aboriginal old people speak their language. That called it mumbo jumbo. A man that would, as I said, humiliate those old people, old full-blood people, which they spoke so many different languages there on Brewarrina Mission. The Wonkamara, who they bought from our Tipperborough way, and the Angledool people, that these people were all forcibly removed to the Brewarrina Mission. So I grew up hearing all sorts of different languages spoken there, but being stopped by the white man of the mission. And sad to say today, we can't speak the language. It's gone. We know everyday words and that we picked up, so at least we still remember. It's good to have a good memory to think back to those days. I was born on Cummeragunga Mission in 1935. My mother was of the Yorta Yorta people, and of course my father, Duncan Ferguson, was from the Wiradjuri people, born over there at Darlington Point, Narandra. So all throughout my life, I've known all about the struggle that they had. I know that there was others with my grandfather, like Sir Jackie Patton, William Cooper, Doug Nichols, Mr. Charles Leon, Billy Reed. Billy Reed was another very strong person from back in those days. And Jimmy Barker on the Brewarrina Mission that used to write letters to Bill Ferguson, the same as his own brother down on the Menindi Mission. They'd send these letters, I believe, to my grandfather, putting in little reports here and there of the treatment, what their people were suffering on the missions. So it's good that I can still remember. I think it's good. I can still see different things. In my mind's eye, I go right back to the hardships on the missions and know just what our people suffered and what these brave men were speaking for. If they wouldn't have spoke out back then, where would we have been today? I wonder. often wonder. We go down to get a dinigal to the corrective services there, and it's sad to see our Aboriginal young fellas, all first offenders. They know nothing of their Aboriginal history. We go there as mentors, Roy and I, and talk to them about such things. They like to know all these things that have happened to us, and we say, what happened to us out here happened to your people too, wherever you came from, North Coast, South Coast, wherever. All our people suffered the same way through these managers on the missions, and how our people were humiliated by the police too. At Brewarrina there, we would have to run and hide when we seen the sidecar coming to the mission. It was such a frightening thing. Always living in fear. Mm. It's a terrible thing to live in fear. I know what it's like, and others that lived on the mission there with us kids at that time. My family, grandfather, like my aunties and uncles, living in Dubbo, they didn't seem to have known much about the happenings on the missions, like, say, I did, because I and my family, we lived through that. There's none of my fathers, like my father or his brothers or sisters, none of them followed my grandfather into politics. But my father, Duncan Ferguson, he accepted the Christian religion, the Christian life, and he never regretted it. And we always had a good relationship throughout the years how he was staying in Brewarrina, just lived, and at Woolloomingal and Denewan, Gadooga, just caring for our Aboriginal people out there on the spiritual side of our life. So perhaps if I would have had an opportunity, which never came my way with education back when I was younger, maybe I would have been able to speak up better and speak for our people. Like back in 1974, there was a health worker's job advertised in Brewarrina, and I applied and I got that position. And I still had that good feeling of helping our people. When you'd see some old fella from Woolloomingal sitting there outside the doctors, or when the big specialists had come, and you'd see him there early and bringing more people back, driving them up, and I said, hey, Uncle, what are you doing here? You've been here early. Oh, yeah, I've got to see the doctor. And I said, well, come on in with me now. And so I took him in and I said, look, old Mr. Bailey's been sitting out there since 9 o'clock. And no one has seen that he, you know, came in. Oh, come in, Mr. Bailey. They turned and switched their story. But things like that. So through over the years, working there for about 8 years in Brewarrina, and I've seen the way that our people were still treated, still put down, still neglected people. And I'm glad that I was able to assist them, to help them, with a good feeling in your heart towards your people. And I know that back then, in 1938, that in January 1938, they had that feeling too. They wanted to help our people, their people. And another thing too that I was told about the day of mourning, after that meeting that day, I don't know if anyone else knows of this, but I was told by an old woman out there at La Perouse, said to me back in the 50s when I went out there, oh, yeah, see down there when they held that big meeting? We went down there to the beach and we all put the pretty flowers, all the flowers we put in the water, and we watched them float away. So I've always had that memory. And I think that old lady, I think they called her Lily Foster. She used to run the hostel out there at La Perouse. Auntie Lily Foster took us kids down there to the beach and saying, oh, yeah, this is the place here where we threw all the flowers in memory of the day of mourning.
That's such a powerful story, and I think you really have given a great insight into the story of and the power of the message that your grandfather told. I think you sell yourself short. I think you and Uncle Roy have played a significant part in the decades since and the role you've played, not just in your local community, but the inspiration you've given to many others, and I can speak for many people in respect of that, because you've been inspirational in your own ways, without a question. And I think, in that sense, you're following on the tradition of your grandfather, Bill Ferguson, in that sense, and that is without question. And it's a great story. I mean, it's not just about 1938 as well, because that was much more than that, and the repercussions of that that came afterwards and continue. I think the thing you said too of going into the jail system and visiting young Aboriginal kids and people that have been sentenced and that, and the role that you, Uncle Roy, play, and the importance you've placed on these people actually gaining their history, because I think Aboriginal history in this country is like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Most of the pieces are missing, and we're still in the process of putting those pieces back. So, I mean, just you relating the stories here today has played a significant part of that, and we certainly thank you.
Can I say one more thing before I go?
Yep, sure.
Going into schools and even down at the jail, you see all skin colours now, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Blue eyes looking at you,
yeah.
Lighter skins, darker skins, and we always say to them, it doesn't matter what our skin colour is, our eye colour, our hair colour, we still descend from the first people of this land.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Art. Moving on now to the descendants we've got of William Cooper, Jack Patton and Jack Tattersall. Aunties Diane O'Brien, Barbara McDonough.
McDonough.
We're going to say Hugh, but and also Barbara Nicholson. And again, a similar thing. I mean, certainly your thoughts and comments of these impressive people and the role they played in the past, but also how it's impacted onto you as individuals as you've moved through your life and your particular journey and what it's meant as far as inspiration is concerned.
Me? well, to me, I found out my inheritance when the kids went to school, when they used to have a thing called ob study. And it used to be $3 a fortnight or something. And a guy called Donnie Williams come along and he said, your kid should be on the Aboriginal, getting this Aboriginal money. I said, oh, no, we're not Aboriginal. We're some kind of Wogs or Heinz Variety, I don't know, but we're not Aboriginal. Anyhow, it took Donnie about a month and he got on to the Aboriginal link-up and then through Peter Reed and Coral, I forget her surname,
Edwards.
They both come up to our place and they done a search. Now, I'd been looking for my people for about 5 years and come to a dead end all the time. Within 12 months, Peter come back and he said, oh, you're a link that's missing in William Cooper's family tree. So then they said about my great-grandfather being this great activist, which he is, a great man. And so I wanted to go back to Cumbra. So I went out to Cumbra Gunja and, oh, that was an eye-opener and learnt a lot about my cousins and ancestors. Before this, I was a pretty wild person with six kids on my own and I was right into land rights and Aboriginal legal service and done a lot of protesting. And so when I went to Cumbra, I seen how run down the place was. So I started to become the Housing Commission. It's called CHADIC. It's Cumbra Gunja Housing and Development. And put in submissions for houses, sewerage, water, roadways, and everything looked great. So I start to grow up a bit, you know, like I was still pretty wild and I seen what was happening. So we did this community development stuff and everything was great. But in the meantime, people said I didn't belong to William Cooper. I belong to the white William Cooper that lives in Penrith. That link up was wrong. So we had to do some more research. My kids followed me down there. That was a good goal for my kids to learn the life living on a mission. One stage there, it was that bad that they said, Mum, we're glad you were taken away, because if we had to grow up here, we wouldn't survive. So I was a bit upset about that. But, well, the kids went back to Sydney and I stayed behind. I stayed there for 8.5 years. But only through Aboriginal Link Up, finding that link, I found my link. Like, I always done this stuff, like marched and that, but I was doing it for my people, but whose people? I didn't know they were Yorta Yorta or Bangarang or Wadjuri. So it was that connection to my great-grandfather that I belonged. And apparently some quotes that I had made at some land councils speeches, the quote that I used to do all the time, which I have forgot, was in my great-grandfather's book. And it just felt like the spirit's there, it's following me through. And when I talked about land and health and education, it was like him talking. My great aunties used to say it's your great-grandfather talking. Anyhow, I moved up to Central Coast and I work in the Aboriginal community, but I work from the Area Health, Gosford Area Health Hospital for North Sydney Central Coast Area Health. And I work there as a sexual health promotion, but I do education programs in the community with our people. Also with the needle syringe program. I won an award in 2006 for an Australia Day award for the best services in our community. Also sit on the board at the Aboriginal Medical Centre at Wyon. I'm the chairperson of Mindaletta Aboriginal Corporation in Yumina. I'm the board member of the Aboriginal Land Council in Wyon, and I sit on the Aboriginal Health Workers Foreman in Sydney. And I work full time. I have 28 grandchildren and I have 21 great grandchildren. And it's a full time job trying to make the young ones get back to reality, get back to the old way and get that respect back that we used to tell the kids when we were kids, you know. It's gone and we've got to get it back. So, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. But, yeah, so that's about finishes my life as William Cooper's granddaughter. My mother's still alive. She lives in Granville. She's 89. She's a very private person where I'm opposite, I'm just out there. So she gets a bit upset sometimes about that. But anyway, life goes on. Thank you very much.
We'll keep moving down the line. Barbara won.
Okay, my turn. I've never done anything as elaborate as Diane. I wish I had, but I was about 14 when I found out that I had darker relatives, but I didn't know where they come in. And I asked a lot of questions, didn't get many answers. One auntie gave me some answers, but not many. It wasn't until I was 34... that I found out I was related to William Cooper and Jack Patton. And I only found out because my mother said I was related to him because we wanted a housing loan. And she told me to apply for it. And I got a letter from Molly Dwyer from the Victorian Legal Service. And she sent a letter, and that's when I found out that I was actually William Cooper's great-granddaughter. And I'm sorry I didn't do any of those things I would have liked to have, but not had the education. But my daughter, she's following. She's going to do it. And I have a son, two sons that are going to do it, two children that aren't interested in it, don't want to know. And that's about it, because I'd like to do a lot more, but I'm getting towards the end of my dream time.
What do you think about the memory of Jack Patton and what that means to the family in that sense,
well,
and that connection?
I think it's very... My kids, my daughter and my grandsons there, they absolutely are wrapped in the idea and yeah. they're interested in it. And for them to find out... We go back seven generations. I mean, how many people... You know, even white people, how far can they go back? Not always. Mm. And we're lucky that the Aboriginal side, we can go back seven. Mm. I think that's absolutely marvellous. And we know where we come from. Mm. And I think the children need to know. That's the whole point. They're not interested. Mm. They've got to be taught. Mm. They've got to find out now that that's your heritage. Yeah, and learn to live with that heritage, because it's all getting mixed up and it's being lost.
Yeah. That's crucial, and we get what Arnie June touched on. I mean, the importance of our history, particularly the generations to come. Yeah. I mean, we've got such incredible heroes and heroines in our past, and the greater knowledge of that which is impacted onto them, of course. I said, like, when I went through school, I mean, when I started school in 1959 and left in 1969, I didn't have any fond memories of school at all. There was nothing about Aboriginal history or culture in the school curriculum. I wasn't encouraged. I got the cane most of the time. I was ripped up out of the seat by the hair and spent most of my time looking out the window. And I was saying earlier in the interview that the only black fella I read about in that particular time period was Jackie, and he was a good black fella. I mean, the time is different, I mean, for our future generations, so they know they've got this incredible history, not just in the traditional past, but across the last 200 years. Many brave people, Aboriginal men and women, who stood up and were counted for and spoke out, I mean, what our people faced right across the country. So these people are inspirational people, very brave, courageous people. Barbara too. And Jack Tattersall, I mean, please.
This morning we were B1 and B2. To this afternoon we're...
We've swapped,
so we're interchangeable. I think I'd just like to talk a little bit about that 1938 day and my father's role in that, and I think it was just such a significant time in history, and I agree that with what has already been said, that those old people, they were so brave, because in those days it was an offence, a criminal offence for Aboriginal people to publicly congregate, so they could have all been arrested and thrown in jail. They had a lot of support, and they had support from the black quarter and they had support from the white quarter as well, vis-a-vis the Workers' Federation, Waterside Workers' Federation, and also the Communist Party, I know, did help in them. My father was a waterside worker in Port Kembla. I didn't know him. I got all this history later. I was never allowed to know my father. And... but... My father was also on the Illawarra Aboriginal Advancement League, which I think was a spin-off thing from VAALS, the Victorian Aboriginal Advancement League. And in that capacity, as I much later found out, because I didn't experience his history firsthand, I had to learn it. And as I later found out, he worked tirelessly for social justice for Aboriginal people. He wrote petitions. He took up petitions to get housing for Aboriginal people, some of which are, the copies of which are in state archives. And he tried to get land for Aboriginal people. He tried to stop the taking away of Aboriginal children. And he was hot on education for Aboriginal people. And he marched in 1938, one of those nameless faces in that 1938 march, along with all those other nameless faces. And one of the reasons I agreed to be here today was to put that right, to get his name up there, maybe as a representative of all of those other nameless faces, but one that I know that could and should be immortalised along with all those other more well-known people. I hope I can achieve that. I hope this forum achieves that. the interesting thing, I know he was an activist. I know he struggled hard for all of those things. But I didn't find that out until much later. I didn't have much of a... I didn't get to know him at all. And when I finally did, I didn't even know his name. And when I finally did get to do the searches through LinkUp, he had already passed away. And when I located his grave, I found black politics on that very day. Because I experienced all that pain of my father not knowing his one and only child, me, not knowing his grandchildren, and us not knowing him. I'd always been pretty much a political animal, but that was the day, because I stood at the crematorium and they'd actually been doing some renovations and the brick wasn't in the wall had been taken down, but the people at the crematorium actually brought me the plaque with his name on it and I held it in my hands and I looked at that and that was the day I wanted to get an AK-47 and go and blow up Parliament. But... And that was the day I found black politics. And I've been active in black politics ever since. I think I've marched in just about every protest march that you can name. I committed myself to the LinkUp organisation and I'm still on the executive board of directors of the LinkUp organisation and will remain so, I think, until the day I die or they kick me out, and I don't think they're likely to do that. I'm one of the longer-serving members on LinkUp now, and I've got the institutional memory, so they can't get rid of me, I hope. I was one of the founding members of the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody Watch Committee. I served as 8 years as chairperson of that committee. In that capacity, I had lots of contact with Aboriginal inmates, families of the victims of deaths in custody, did the hard yards all that way. And in the whole process, I went and got myself a tertiary education. And I finished up teaching in universities, and I'm still connected to University of Wollongong, and I do lots and lots of stuff like that. Also a member of the Indigenous Social Justice Association. I've served on the AMS Board of Directors. I've had a couple of stints on that and generally done all that and raised a big family. I got 16.2 months grandchildren, 2 months, 7 to go before it arrives, and one great-grandy. But it was interesting, if I go back now to the 1938 stuff and my father's role in that, that was, I think there's a real synergy because what happened later in my life and before I actually found out that my father had been involved in the 1938 stuff, I got drawn in with the Aboriginal History and Heritage Council in Sydney via my old aunt, Auntie Nelda Rome, and Jenny Munro, who was then chair of the Metropolitan Land Council in Sydney, and another Aboriginal woman from Sydney, Doreen Kelly, and a French woman by the name of Giselle Masiqua, who was a student at UTS in Sydney, and she, Auntie Nelda Rome, had got Giselle to do her research paper on the 1938 day of mourning. And out of that 1938, out of that research that Giselle did, Giselle uncovered this fact that there was a development application on the old Australia Hall, the site of the meeting in 1938. And so Giselle embarked on a mission to stop that. So she called in Jenny and Doreen and Troy McAvoy and a few others, and we all got together and we formed the Aboriginal History and Heritage Council to go to wore on saving the day of Morningside. I actually had some... We fought a six-year battle to get that site. We took up petitions, we did all sorts of things, and we did all this over this six-year period. We had a reenactment march on the 60th anniversary. We had a reenactment march in Sydney, and we gathered at the town hall, and I think, if my memory serves me correct, our good friend Jack Horner was also present on that day with a lot of descendants and I think a couple of the originals. Yeah, you were there that day, yeah. We got it at last. We're trying to work out where we first met. And we marched from the town hall, followed the same route as the original protesters did in a silent march, remembering that the original protesters were doing that at their peril. So we took on a bit of that peril, and when we got to Goulburn Square, we did what they did. We sat down in the middle of the intersection, much to the chagrin of Sydney drivers, for 20 minutes. And then we marched onto the hall, and as the ancestors had done, we did. We asked all the white fellas to stay outside, and we went in. Only blackfellas could go in to the hall, which is now, of course, the Mandolin Theatre. In that hall, one of our number got up and read out the original manifesto from 1938. And we all knew that everything that was in that manifesto was just as relevant in 1998 as it was in 1938. We were still fighting the same battles. We'd sent petitions to the New South Wales Heritage Council. We did so many things to stop that development application, which was going to knock the building down. We wanted to keep it. And in the end, we won. We won the battle, and we got a permanent conservation order placed on the facade of the building. In advertising for that reenactment, we had posters made. Were they showing some? Yeah, that's it there. Similar part of it, yeah. We had posters made. I've got this here. This is one of the original posters from 1998, and we had it done in the exact same format that the original poster was done in 1938. So we tried to replicate everything to make it as powerful as we possibly could. I just thought... And then in the end, we finally won the battle. I sent off a petition to the Heritage Council. And can I read that? Yeah, I've got to get the glasses. Hang on. I was pretty angry when I wrote this, and I think it shows. I think. To Rajiv Mahi, who is the Heritage Council of New South Wales, it is with immense sorrow that I learn of the proposed development of this enormously significant site. I am distressed to learn also that the Minister, Mr. Craig Knowles, has consistently refused to place a permanent conservation order on the site. His reasons for not doing so can only be interpreted as meaning that he does not believe that sites of significance for Aboriginal people can exist in the built environment, which by extension suggests that Aboriginal people are relegated to the natural world of flora and fauna. This is extremely offensive as it denies our presence in the urban environment. Further, the rejection of the site as a place of historical and political importance for Aboriginal people is to perpetuate the atrocities of the past where the true histories of this country have been sanitised. It seems that government authorities in this country will not be satisfied until every trace of an Aboriginal presence on the landscape has been erased. This site has enormous significance for Aboriginal people in that its use by our fathers and mothers in 1938 marked a new direction in the struggle of our people to gain justice and equality for all Aborigines. On that day in 1938, Aboriginal resistance became politicised. Is this too much for you to bear? If so, then I suggest you put on a stiff upper lip and consider what Aboriginal people have had to endure in and during the colonisation of this country and are still doing so today. I will remind you of Hansenism, of WIC and the stolen generations. To deny our people of the very basic right to have one, just one building in the CBD which we recognise as sacred and significant is to tell us that we do not rate as highly as the colonial garbage you immortalise in the permanent conservation order you placed on an incinerator. I believe it is time that people in positions of influence and power took the blinkers off and recognised there is a world and a people out there who are no longer willing to sit in the gutter and accept the crumbs from the white man's table. I therefore call on you to reject out of hand the development proposal for the Day of Morningside and turn this building over to the only people in this country to whom it has such spiritual, historical and political meaning. We won the battle. The Lord Mayor of Sydney, the then Frank Sartor, put on a celebratory function at the town hall, and this is my invitation to that. The Lord Mayor Frank Sartor requests the pleasure of the company of Miss Barbara Nicholson at a reception for the National Aboriginal History and Heritage Council to celebrate the permanent conservation of the 1938 Day of Mourning and Protest site. And that's one of the proudest days of my life. The wonderful thing, and where I think there's an absolutely beautiful synergy, is that I did all that with that protest without knowing that my father had been one of the original protesters.
Well, that carries on the tradition, doesn't it? I think you're
You can't kill the spirit.
Absolutely. I think Barbara is a walking and talking memorial to the courage of her dad in the past, and it's carried on through her. So power to you. It's wonderful. I think we should applaud our panel. Wonderful insight. And again, but it continues on the courage of the past as it's continued on through the descendants themselves. Jay, are we to swap over now? Is that the case? I mean, okay, we're going to have Suzanne and Auntie Olive and Esther the cat come up and speak about the 1938 Day of Mourning. It's great to have you here and again to give that perspective on the Day of Mourning, the event itself, and I have an opportunity to have personal insight from family memories and how important that is. So, Suzanne, do you want to lead the discussion?
Okay. First of all, allow me to please also acknowledge the traditional custodians of this country on which I'm speaking on today. Okay, so I wasn't there in 1938. It came to me to be a bit of an important task for me to be able to acknowledge publicly that my family was involved in that. In 2004, I wrote an article which got published in our national Aboriginal newspaper called the Koori Mail. And I got that story for that article from my Aunt Sylvia, who is still alive. She's just not here. I wasn't going to say she's not with us today, but she certainly is. But she stayed in Sydney. She doesn't like the Canberra cold. But remarkably too, Aunty Sylvia remembers that day, but she wasn't in the photograph. As far as we know, the only two people still alive today from that 1938 photo are these two women here. The reason, though, that I wrote the article is because I found... I'd grown up, and my cousin is here today, Aunty Esther's daughter, and we grew up, as did all our other cousins and extended family, knowing that that was Nan and the aunties and the uncles in that photograph. But after this, I think it was actually during this ice age, obviously, yes, that was about 5 years ago, that I was doing some research on another project in Sydney about the Sydney Olympic Park, the Aboriginal heritage of Sydney Olympic Park. And in the process of doing that, this photo kept on popping up at the Mitchell Library in Sydney. And then there was an open pictorial day about the photographs, and there was never any... Not only was there no names attached to the women and children in this photograph, but at one of the pictorial open days held at the State Library in Sydney, a senior Aboriginal woman who was there with a group of young people that she was, her students... tapped me on the elbow and said, "I'll see that man there, that little boy there. I know him. He lives in the Blue Mountains." And I thought, okay, this is going a bit too far. That would be that little boy right in front, because that's my mum's cousin. My mum is younger. These are my two older aunties, two of my older aunties. My mum's younger. And I knew from mum, and also because I was very fortunate out of all the family, my grandmother was the mother of 11 children. So she had quite a few to choose from to live with, and I happened to be the grandchild that was very fortunate, along with my brother, to have her live with us pretty much most of my life. So that through connection for me has been an extraordinary influence on my life. But knowing that story, I knew that Uncle Nino wasn't with us anymore, and I felt this has to be corrected. This story's got to go out. So, yeah, I trained as a journalist. I did my undergraduate degree in communications at Bathurst, which is home country for me, because home country for us is Wiradjuri country, which is quite vast. It takes up most of what's called now the central west of New South Wales and much of the Riverina. My grandfather is a Yorta Yorta man. He's no longer with us. He was from Cummerganja, and hence the reason why he was there. And again, I'm getting all this story because of what I've been told, which I take to be truth. And later, after the aunts will talk, there is something I would like to present to you all today, which will be the first time that's been presented, because even though I have written this article and I have identified and spoken with my family and my aunties about it, there is a clique of historians who have point-blank denied that that is who my family says they are, and has constantly argued for further evidence because she can't seem to find it in the written documents in the Mitchell Library. My first thought was obviously, well, maybe you're looking in the wrong place, but it's not my job to tell a professional what to do. 4 years down the track, the poor woman is still no closer. And I want to show you all today, because that evidence has been around for actually longer than the 1938 photograph. So I'm happy to show it to you today, but I'll leave that if you want to, or should we do it now?
Yeah,
I'm happy. Sorry?
Do you want to have some response here from aunties?
I'm taking the floor. Yeah, of course, aunt.
And then show the image
and talk to that.
Yeah.
Yarn on.
Yeah, okay. First, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and very proud to meet you again. We did meet at the last, I do recall, I think, a question was asked of me earlier, what would have inspired mum to be there on that day? And going back in my mind, listening to the beautiful stories that was told here, I do recall some of the elders back on the reserve, on the mission, they were inspired also, I'm pretty sure, by what was going on down here in Sydney. And I do remember Mr. Ferguson coming to Cowra many years ago, but I thought they were like, you know, the Christians used to go around with the conventions. That's who I thought they were, because I was too young at the time. But that's what they must have been doing, you know, gathering all this support. And I do remember a guy who used to write political letters, and that was named Ernie Whitty, one of our elders on Cowra Mission. And I was pleased that somebody mentioned Pearly Gibb. Now, played a very big role, and she worked for the Protection Board. Now, any information she got, she used to filter it out to these men. which I think enabled them at that particular time to send word down to Camera to prepare them that they were going to come down and remove the children. So I think they moved off the reserve overnight. But that's the, and also, June, I'm very pleased to hear from you because I did meet three of your aunties, and I think they're, two of them are still alive, is that right? Isabel and June?
I don't think June's still there.
Is she there? Anyway, Isabel McCullum was Bill Ferguson's daughter, and she was the first Aboriginal nursing sister at Prince Alfred Hospital. And I had the good fortune to meet these people. And I was too little, as I said, at the day of mourning there. But I, the question I answered there was that what would inspire my family to be there? I think they're all political, all, you know, motivated in some way, but also inspired. And I got my inspiration when I got involved with the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And I think that's where we met, Mr. Horner, the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And Charles Perkins inspired us to continue on doing what we're doing and fight for what we believed in. And you want to say anything else all about... what I just stating that I'm very proud, and who wouldn't be proud to be part of history like this?
Yeah.
Good God, I mean, we didn't know it at the time. Well, that's what somebody said to me. We lived to see the day. We didn't think we would because of our, you know, so, longevity or whatever it is, or lack of it. And so we did survive. And at the time, we knew we were in that photograph. We always knew that. But we didn't know we had to prove it. And sorry. But, I mean, acknowledging it now, I'm very, very grateful to you all for having it put up there like that now, and it is part of history. And my God, I am very proud of that. I'm proud, and I'm pretty sure my offsprings will be too, that eventually history, which is history, and the kids can be proud of it.
Yeah. Well said. Well, Susan, do you want to talk to the family? I'm not sure if Arnie wants to. I know Arnie's a little bit nervous, but it's great that she's actually stepped up into the front of the stage there. But do you want to talk to the photo, the image you've got?
Photo.
Do you want to bring that up?
The big one.
I'd love to, if you don't mind me showing you all. Yeah.
As I say, I was motivated, if you want to bring them both up, actually, to... this is the day of mourning photo, which is up there on the PowerPoint. The thing is, when I saw this, it's been reprinted. This photo's been reprinted numerous times. And as I say, I've often seen it, women and children unknown, the women presumed to be, or straight out named as Mrs. Selena Patton and Mrs. Helen Grosvenor. With the women either side, you know, named as this. And for me, for Aboriginal people working in history and commemorating these kinds of things, it's very important to us that you get the story right, because once an untruth is out there, it takes a long time to kill it off. In fact, I'm trying to remember the name of some old philosopher who said, history are not just stories, it's what we base our truths upon. Mm. So these kinds of things, you know, I just felt it really important, obviously. And I also acknowledge, too, that, you know, ours isn't the only one. I know that there are other people whose involvement has been suppressed, which I think is a bit silly. You know, there's lots of people. You can't just, you know, you're not just a movement in one person.
Mm.
So when I first put this up, and I must acknowledge Mr. Jack Horner, because his publication and one other are the only ones that have correctly named the women and children in this photograph. Mm. As I say, about 4 years ago, I did notify another area, which won the New South Wales Premier's History Award, might I add, and notified them that they actually had the wrong names there because they were regarded as either Ferguson or Patton children. To this day, that has not been corrected, and it's still been an argument which I have, you know, just not just pressed, but, well, here it is, you know. If you can go and find other evidence, then I'm all ears for it. Mm. That hasn't happened. It's unfortunate we can't get a close-up of this or anything, but this is the 1938 photograph, which was taken on the 26th of January, as we all know. And that's Auntie Esther, the little girl in the front, and that's Auntie Ollie.
They asked me to march now, and I said, I'm too old. I've been doing this since I was 18 months old.
She's done her share of marching. This here photo, though, and you might have noticed up here on the PowerPoint, there's a photo from 1900 in front of the church at Cummeragunga. This is purely by chance, might I add. It's not as though Aboriginal people were running around with, you know, brownie box cameras in those days. So what they did do is that they sent around people from the, you know, government departments or the missionaries, the churches, to take a photo of the Aboriginal people in front of the church. That one was taken up here of Cummeragunga. This one here was taken at Cowra, Arambi Mission Cowra. It's dated here, May 12th, 1937, Coronation Day, Cowra Aboriginal Station. There's Auntie Esther there. And by all means, if you want to come up and have a look. Being nursed by my grandmother, Louisa Ingram. Auntie Ollie is being nursed by the eldest sister. That's Auntie Sylvia, who was the source of the story for the article. And the two boys, Uncle Choco, or Uncle Philip, or we call him Uncle Choco, and Uncle Ike, are in these. And these kids don't really change, I suppose. Well, they do change a lot, but in 6 months, these are only 6 months apart. And as I say, this evidence has been there, but I've been constantly asked for the past 4 years, prove it, prove it, prove it. And I thought, well, if you're half as good at what you say you are, you should be able to find it yourself. You don't need me. So I invite you, please, to come up and have a look at this. And
okay?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was quite funny because I didn't have a really good copy of this picture until I picked Auntie Ollie up on the way down to Canberra yesterday. And I said, Aunt, I've got to pick this, because you wouldn't have been able to make it out in the photo that I had. And for me, that's what it's all about, because you have a lot of people who are informing on Aboriginal history. There's a lot of informants. How do you know that they know what they're talking about? How do you know that they're not just spinning your yarn? So for us, it's not that I need to come up here and, you know, thump my chest that that's my family. It's because as Australians, you deserve to know the real truth, you know, not something that's been, I suppose, filtered through something else because the written evidence isn't there. But for me, just to get back to why I picked this photo up off the wall, is because that's where you'll find it, okay? You'll find it through talking with Aboriginal people. You'll find it through just picking up the phone, making a phone call, or asking around, because there'll always be somebody that knows somebody. In fact, that's how I think LinkUp works. That's one of the reasons why. We always know who's who. And if you don't, then there's a question mark about you. And the other thing too is that if you're ever invited into someone's home, you look at the photographs, because that's where the stories are. And you'll always find those things there. And I've got to say, I don't know any Aboriginal person who won't talk. They might be a bit suspicious of you first up, but if you want to know, you know, that's what I found most definitely.
So people are quite welcome to look at that later, because she might be a distant relative of something, because there's Bamblets, Murrays, Williams.
And that's how we understand each other. We recognise the clan names, because the clan names are place. So if someone mentions, my children, for example, have taken their dad's name. My ex-husband is a third generation French Australian. So my children carry the name Bagent. There aren't any Aboriginal Bagents apart from them. So in order for them to be identified through other Aboriginal people, they have to be asked, okay, so who's your family? So they will always say Ingram. Everybody knows where the Ingram. So you must be from Cowra. That's how it works. So same if there's a Mackenzie. If you meet someone with the surname Mackenzie, you can be pretty sure. You'll ask them, are they from, you know, Walgett or Northwest, somewhere up that way. And that's why it's very important that the names are attached to the faces because the faces are attached to the places, and places are land, and that's where we come from.
I think there's an important point, Susan. You said there's not a written record, but you draw attention to Jack, and we are honoured to have Jack in the audience here. I mean, Jack and Jean were such great campaigners and supporters of Aboriginal people for such a long time, and Jack's book is an absolute landmark. Now, if Jack is named the children in that book, it is in the written record, and Jack goes back many, many decades before and was speaking to the people who were there and had insight into that event. I think there it is in the written record as far as I'm concerned. That's beyond argument. No one had more attention to detail than Jack. Yeah. And certainly that the book that Jack wrote still stands today as a great testament to Jack, and also the people that were providing the information and the knowledge to Jack through their memories, which Jack wrote up.
I agree. I guess that's what the Ice Age kind of represents, really, is selective kind of histories. And
absolutely.
For me, that just doesn't fly because it takes... Everybody's got a story, you know? So there are lots of people who are involved.
Yeah. Yeah. Only Olive and Esther want to make any other comments on the day or their memories of what it's meant to them to carry that memory through their lives together.
And what's the word at the moment, Josh?
Yeah.
I'm very proud. Very proud and very honoured to be here. And very, you know, it's you're putting us. I know we were only babies, really,
yep,
and you're putting
right.
us with you know, very distinguished people.
That's right.
And they're part of history.
Yeah.
And wasn't active, but I'm very proud of the fact that my parents were.
Yeah.
That they saw fit to be there and support the way they did. Yeah. And I think we do get a little bit of that from our parents, or from Mum in particular, because we have challenged the system over the years.
Yeah.
If it didn't work for us, we challenged it. So
that day, Dad was down to the mine with the...
day, actually, I think it's the only time I've seen that photograph was in Miss Dorner's book, over the page where they were down at the domain. And a lot of the men in that were down there with the tarpaula muster, you know. And I think they were the fundraisers. Well, Dad was part of that. And the eldest girl, Sylvia, was out at La Perouse with our grandmother, Dad's mother, Louisa, Isabel. I got all my names mixed up now. Louisa was my mother. Isabel was my other grandma, but Elizabeth Bamblett. She took Sylvia out to La Perouse for that throwing in, I think, that day.
Grandfather's in this photo as well, so the missing, you know, man that is not
in
that photo.
That's why he wasn't on that photograph that day.
The only reason, and as I say, it's been commonly noted that, you know, children unknown, it's just really interesting that the women have not been identified for such a long time in the public record. Which is a bit crazy, really, because, you know, there's such a big part. I mean, everyone that's been speaking here today, apart from poor old John,
are
the women, So, That's right, That was because I was speaking with one of the curators here, Kipley, and I think it's because I'd raised it. I think IATSIS had... talked about it being the 70th anniversary, and the names again were missing. So I shot off an email, and I mean, each of them had to satisfy themselves that, you know, I'm not spinning them yarn, and you know, absolutely, that is what I would expect you to do. So that's how that came about. Yeah, so it's lovely to know that you know.
But I know my grandkids and great-grandkids are going to be proud.
Yeah.
You know. And
I
it's...
I have to say that I was at the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, and I remember Esther fighting and all the Ingram ladies, and she took me to waltz.
Did you deal Deb?
No, I wasn't Deb, I was just there.
She told me to waltz too.
I trained at five debutante balls at the Sydney Town Hall.
Two balls, one back.
Yep. Good to see you, Mark.
I think that should be another session. I think what's also important here is, I mean, like with 38, I mean, it's 70 years, and I mean, it didn't end there. I think what stalled the movement, though, was the onset of World War II at that particular moment. Aboriginal activism didn't finish then either. It continued through the 50s and into the 60s. Significantly, though, non-Indigenous historians and the wider community largely believe that Aboriginal political activism began in the 1960s. It is very important that we recognise those events of the 60s. I mean, Charlie Perkins with the Freedom Rides, you know, picking up a whole bunch of non-Indigenous students and lobbing them on a bus and going around and exposing the horrific conditions that were impacting on Aboriginal people and communities and putting that through the media to the wider populace of this country. The Gurindji walk-off at Wave Hill in 66, the Gurindji were masters of the media. They also had great support from the trade union movement in 66. The 67 referendum, what, 92.7, was that? Thought I was right. I thought I'd better check with my another Indigenous historian here. I didn't want to get caught out. But you know, 92.7% of the population voted with Aboriginal people in 67. I might add that the vote went the opposite way in Kempsey, and I think that it does explain something of the situation in Kempsey even today. The Tent Embassy in 72, the 1988 bicentennial. These are all important events, but history goes back much further, and certainly with the day of mourning and these particular activists of this time period, they need wider knowledge in the non-Indigenous community and the place in history as far as that's concerned. And I'll certainly give an insight into my grandfather as well in relation to that.
Just add to that, yep. Like the inspiration, I think, it was like one of my younger sisters during the referendum, actually leading up to the referendum, you might remember, Francis, when they got mostly young people from the foundation to go out and get as many people in Aboriginals identified.
Yeah.
And one of my sisters knew that her neighbour was an Aboriginal. And she went out and asked, would she get the support? And she settled the dog on her. So go, I'm not Aboriginal. Yeah. And also with the Tent Embassy, during the course of that, when they first set it up,
yeah,
they had to move and, you know, they're building a new one. Yeah. They sat the old one.
Yeah.
My brother and his mate, who was a brother to, you might, the Canberrians would know, Ned Simpson. Well, his brother Neil Simpson and my brother Lachlan Ingram sat there and kept that Tent Embassy going. And let his wife battle up there with the kids, but they kept it going till the other fellas come down, so that it wasn't lost, you know. So, but these are things that I said what I go on about is that, you know, acknowledge those who have contributed.
Yeah,
don't forget them.
Absolutely, that's the crucial point. We might leave questions till just after and bring the events in. Francis, sorry, did you want to add something? No, we will leave the questions till later. That's fine. Look, I think we might leave the panel here. I might just give a quick overview of my grandfather and the 1920s movement, and then we might move on to questions from the audience, I think, and we'll leave the panel here, and the other panel members that are here might want to contribute as well. And I'm similar as the other descendants in the fact that I take incredible pride and inspiration from the memory and legacy of my grandfather. And I think that the way, not just the way that I conduct myself in academia, which is still a foreign zone as far as I'm concerned, for me, like a lot of Aboriginal people of my generation, I don't have fond memories of the school years. I started school in 59, I left in 69, and there was nothing for me in that school curriculum, history or culture, and nothing to connect with. And I got out the door as soon as I possibly could. For the next 25 years, I worked in many jobs, barman, truck driver, builder's labourer, hairdresser, on-flight groom looking after racehorses flying around the world, whole host of jobs. But one thing that stood me in great stead was I was an absolutely ballistic reader, particularly of history, and I consumed an incredible amount of literature. I think, in some sense, I educated myself. I went to university just shy of my 40th birthday, not by design, basically by accident. I was just putting some family history together. My grandfather was a high-profile Aboriginal activist of the 1920s, 14 years before the Day of Mourning protest and the APA and the Australian Aborigines League. He formed the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, which formed in Sydney in 1924. I went to Newcastle University just because I was putting some family history together. My grandfather's story for my father, my uncles and aunties, cousins, extended family members, that was the limit of what I wanted to do. I went to Wallatooga, the School of Aboriginal Studies at Newcastle University. The then director, Tracy Bunder, Murray woman from Queensland. I had the briefest of words with Tracy. By the time I turned around, I'd been kidnapped. I was suddenly enrolled as a university student. I'm still scratching my head about that, but and I still owe her immensely for that encouragement that she gave me. I've did a diploma, I've completed a BA, subsequently a PhD, Five books later, I'm a professor. It's been an amazing journey. First member of my family to go to university. My father was an Aboriginal jockey, which is another book I wrote about, which is about Aboriginal jockeys. I'd been at university 2 weeks in the diploma course. Another old fellow at the racetrack at Broadmeadow in Newcastle said to me, "Father, what's John doing these days?" And the old man said, "Oh, he's over at the university." And the other fellow said, "What's he doing over there?" He said, "Oh, I think he's a professor or something. I'd only been there 2 weeks as a diploma student." But he must have had incredible insight, because eventually down the track, that's what did happen to me. And I suppose this talk is a little bit of, a shameless self-promotion. My book, Fight for Liberty and Freedom, which is about my grandfather and the 1920s Aboriginal political fight, has only just recently been released, and Gary Foley and Jeff McMullen launched the book in Sydney. And I've basically been doing talks all around the place. Gary Foley had a launch down at Melbourne Uni, and I spoke at Eltham Book Fair and the Sydney Writers' Festival, the Dreaming Festival. I've been everywhere. But like that song, I might break into that a minute. But it's been an incredible journey for me, particularly from my educational background, which was extremely limited in my school years, I have to say. As I said, I didn't receive much encouragement. My grandfather's memory and organisation has been forgotten and erased in many instances, I believe, as far as that particular movement was concerned. And that's incredible, because the work that I've done has divulged, exposed the incredible impact they had at that particular point. Non-Indigenous historians have gone on for quite some time that the early Aboriginal political movements were basically led by non-Indigenous Christians and humanitarian groups. This particular group in the 1920s was all about black nationalism. The people that influenced my grandfather were people he came into contact with. Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world, who my grandfather met in 1907. In 1908 in Sydney, when Johnson was here and actually won the world heavyweight title. Marcus Garvey. My grandfather was a dock worker in Sydney, as were many other Aboriginal men, and Barb actually related with her dad. And that's where a lot of political fire come from, as well as their experience on the docks and a connection with the trade union movement. My grandfather working on the docks in the World War I period. They were very confrontational. They challenged Billy Hughes' conscription policy, and they actually beat that referendum. The Marcus Garvey influences, today Garvey is recognised as leading the biggest black movement ever established in the United States. He influenced Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Elijah Muhammad, the Black Panthers. This organisation was operational, centred in Harlem from 1916 through to the mid-1920s, until Garvey was jailed by the US government and then deported because he was a West Indian. People like my grandfather in Australia come into contact with African Americans and West Indians and South Africans, gained their manifestos, documents about what was going on, the global struggle of oppressed people, particularly black people. This made a big impression on people like my grandfather. The ideology of Garveyism, a lot of scholars today seemed to centre on that Garvey was all about going back to Africa. Garvey never, ever said that, other than in a spiritual sense, that black fellows in the United States should look to a spiritual homeland. He said it in a spiritual sense. You need to connect to your homeland. That had a big connection with Aboriginal people here in this country, I have to tell you. You need to be connected to your country. Also, the incredible strength of the Garvey message was all about take pride in your own history, take pride in your own culture. This resonated powerfully with Aboriginal activists. They incorporate a lot of Garveyism to what they were actually saying. My grandfather and other Aboriginal activists in Sydney of this particular period actually joined Garvey's organisation. They were part of a union chapter, operational in Sydney from 1920 to 1924. In 1924, they moved away from that and they formed their own organisation, the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association. They obviously realised that they needed to put it in an Aboriginal context, and that was the best way to take the fight up. Their message, their manifesto, their platform, they wanted enough land for each and every Aboriginal family in the country. This was sent to state governments, the federal government, published widely, not right across New South Wales, but also the message went to Queensland, Victoria, and even South Australia, and was also published in the United States, stuff that I uncovered over there. Very strong message, not recognised. They also fought strongly that the New South Wales Aborigines Protection Board's act of taking away Aboriginal kids from their family had to be stopped. They wanted to defend a distinct Aboriginal cultural identity. They wanted the complete abolishment of the Aboriginal Protection Board and to be replaced by an all-Aboriginal group to run Aboriginal affairs. They held four conferences, the first in Sydney in 1925, April 1925, at St David's Church and Hall in Surry Hills. Over 200 people, Aboriginal people, were in attendance. They were front page news in that particular incident. And I'll just read a very short piece of that particular conference. And this again challenges the people, as I say, these right-wing extremists who tend to think that, the Aboriginal political activism began in the 60s, the Windschuttles and the Pearsons and the Ackermans and all those sort of people, that the whole movement, the self-push for self-determination began then in the 60s and the 70s, led by the Whitlam government. The front page newspapers in 1925 said, on Aborigines' aspirations, first Australians to help themselves, self-determination. And another headline, Aborigines in conference, self-determination is their aim, to help a people. My grandfather, as the president, began his inaugural address with the words, brothers and sisters, we have much business to transact, so let's get right down to it. He went on to say, which was recorded in the press at the time, we aim at the spiritual, the political, the industrial and the social. We want to work out our own destiny. Our people have not had the courage to stand together in the past, but now we are united and are determined to work for the preservation for all of those interests which are near and dear to us. Their second conference in Kempsey, again in 1925, ran over 3 days. All the papers delivered were delivered by Aboriginal people, all Aboriginal organisation. They had 11 groups, 11 chapters of the organisation with over 600 members. But 700 people were there at that conference in Kempsey in 1925. The papers were about health, kids, land, children, education. A lot of the stuff we're still fighting for today, they were fighting for then. My grandfather delivered a powerful resolution which was sent to the New South Wales Premier at the time and published widely in the press in New South Wales. And the resolution closed the conference, and he said these words. As it is the proud boast of Australia that every person born beneath the Southern Cross is born free, irrespective of origin, race, colour, creed, religion, or any other impediment, we, the representatives of the original people in conference assembled, demand that we shall be afforded the same full right and privilege of citizenship that is enjoyed by all other sections of the community. These are extremely powerful words in the mid-1920s. And if you go through the history and the anthropologist, when Aboriginal people belonged to the Stone Age, we were a dying race. We couldn't be educated. They were going to smooth the dying pillow. This particular material quite clearly shows these were articulate, eloquent, educated Aboriginal men and women, statesmen and women. This organisation, and Susan touched on that, this was very heavily involved women all the way through it. This is not an Aboriginal men's club here, and that's been the case of all of our fights throughout history. You know, we stand together in that sense. The organisation had another conference in Grafton in 26, another one in Lismore in 1927. Their manifesto went to the Jack Lang, the Premier of New South Wales, in 1927. And again, it hadn't changed over a three-year period, land, children, culture, Aboriginal people being in charge of Aboriginal affairs and the abolishment of the Protection Board. The Premier sent it back to the Aborigines Protection Board for their thoughts, and their response was, Fred Maynard is a man of illogical views who will do more harm to Aboriginal people, and the Premier is not to occupy his time unduly with this radical viewpoint. They didn't send that response to my grandfather, but the response came through that basically Aboriginal affairs was going to be left in the control of the Aborigines Protection Board, and that he knew quite well that the Protection Board had interfered. He wrote a 3.5-page letter to Jack Lang, which I think still stands today as one of the most powerful ever penned by an Aboriginal activist, and I certainly won't go into reading 3.5 pages here, but I'll read a short piece out of that letter that he directed to Jack Lang. And he said, and this is in relation to basically the government taking no notice of Aboriginal demands. He said, I wish to make it perfectly clear on behalf of our people that we accept no condition of inferiority as compared with the European people. Two distinct civilizations are represented by the respective races. On one hand, we have the civilization of necessity, and on the other, the civilization coincident
with a bounteous supply of all the requirements of the human race, that the European people, by the arts of war, destroyed our more ancient civilization is freely admitted, and that by their vices and diseases our people have been decimated is also patent. But neither of these facts are evidence of superiority. Quite the contrary is the case. The members of the AAPA have also noted the strenuous efforts of the trade union leaders to attain the condition which existed in our country at the time of invasion by Europeans. The men only worked when necessary. We called no man master, and we had no king. Again, an incredibly powerful statement, you know, that was delivered at that particular time period, 80 years ago. We're highlighting here today that it's 70 years since the day of mourning. It is also 80 years since my grandfather's organisation disappeared from public view, and they were basically hunted and hounded out of existence by the police acting for the New South Wales Aborigines Protection Board. And that story is in the book. I'll close with another short letter my grandfather... Well, it's not a short letter, it's a long letter my grandfather wrote. The AAPA established a very strong Aboriginal community network where news... My grandfather wasn't allowed to go onto Aboriginal missions or reserves. The reality was the Protection Board said he was inciting revolt. But the community knew when he was about. And unfortunately, in years gone by, I had the good fortune to do interviews with some of the kids who actually ran off places like Bellbrook with messages to my grandfather. The community knew when he was about. Kids would run off and they'd have messages what the hell was going on to people on the reserves during the 20s. And they'd meet my grandfather under a bridge. And one of the messages that got through to Sydney to my grandfather in 1927 involved a young Aboriginal girl, 14 years of age, been taken from a family, sent to Angledool in western New South Wales, where she was repeatedly raped by the mission manager. The Protection Board, she became pregnant, the Protection Board bunged her on a train and sent her to Sydney. She had the baby. The records say that the baby died. We're not to know that. The baby may well have been removed and given away to someone. The girl was immediately put back on the train and sent back to Angledool, the place where the abuse has happened. When this message reached my grandfather, and I've said this many times, I mean, no matter how many times I read this letter, I always get moved by it. It's just, it's so powerful and so moving. He began this letter, he said, "My darling little sister, I'm speaking to you now as a big bro." This is 1927. "What a wicked conception, what a fallacy under the so-called pretense that administration re the board, governmental control, etc. I say deliberately the whole damnable thing has got to stop, and by God's help it shall. I may tell you, and listen, girlie, your case is one in dozens with our girls. More is the pity. God forbid those white robbers of our women's virtues seem to do just as they like with downright impunity, and mind you, my dear girl, the law stands for it. There is no clause in our own Aboriginal Act which stands for principles for our girls. That is to say, any of these white fellows can take our girls down and laugh to scorn yet. With impunity, that which they have been responsible for, they escape all their obligations every time. These tyrannous methods under the so-called administrative laws, read the Aboriginal Act, have got to be blotted out, as they are an insult to intelligent, right-thinking people. We are not going to be insulted any longer than it will take to wipe it off the statute book. That's what our association stands for: liberty, freedom, and the right to function in our own interests. Are we going to stand for these things any longer? Certainly not. Away with the damnable insulting methods which are degrading. Give us a hand, stand by your own native Aboriginal officers and fight for liberty and freedom." Sadly, the girl never received the letter. The manager opened the letter and it was sent back to the Protection Board and the New South Wales State Government, who intensified their attacks against my grandfather, not just in the press but also on the street. And the Aboriginal organisation disappeared from public view in 1928 and through, as I said, hounded out of existence by the police. They didn't stop their agitation. Interviews with uncles and aunties and my father and other people connected to the organisation said they continued to hold meetings. Sid Ridgway's police, which included Dick Johnson, Tom Lacey, Sid Ridgway, my grandfather. My grandfather bobs up and continuing in the early 30s in records at La Perouse, and the La Perouse community said they had aligned themselves with the AAPA. One old uncle I interviewed probably 15 years ago was a greenkeeper at University of Sydney in the early 1930s, mid-1930s, and he said the last time he heard my grandfather speak was in the grounds of the University of Sydney at that particular time period. Interestingly enough, with the government inquiry that came up in 1937, there was a letter in the archives, and Bill Ferguson did speak at that, as did Pearly Gibbs, but there was a letter there that was sent to the government, particularly to the Protection Board and to the government, to say names of people who should have the opportunity to speak. And Johnny Donovan, very highly respected member of the Nambucca community, was one of those people whose names were put forward. Jimmy Doyle was another, Gary Foley's great-grandfather. And my grandfather, in this letter, Fred Maynard, an Aboriginal man from Lakemba, should be given opportunity to speak. None of those people were allowed to speak. None of the 1920s group were ever seen visible in the 1930s, late 1930s. Particularly with the day of mourning. The levels of harassment by the police was so severe on these people that, they, as I said, they were driven underground. Tied to that, my grandfather in 1928, going taking back a little bit further, he married my grandmother, a white woman. Now, in 1928, it was without argument my grandfather was the highest profiled Aboriginal activist in the country at that particular point. But he'd stepped across a boundary which certainly troubled non-Indigenous Australia. For an Aboriginal man to marry a white woman was taboo. It was okay for white men to abuse Aboriginal women wherever and whenever they wanted, if they could get away with it, and they got away with it a lot. But for an Aboriginal man to marry a white woman at that particular time period was very confronting. I might add my grandmother was not from a privileged background. She was from a mining family who'd come from England, Bolton, and they'd gone up to the coalfields in Cessnock. My grandmother was working at a coffee shop on Central Station. She was a single mother when she met my grandfather. Unbelievable, well, it's not unbelievable, I suppose, that's the stigma of the day. In marrying my grandfather, her own family ostracised her completely, and she was cut off from her own family for marrying an Aboriginal man at that particular point. The organisation, as I said, disappeared, and it disappeared not just in the time period, but also in memory. My grandfather, the stories are that he had an accident on the wharf. He was in and out of hospital for 12 months. One leg was broken in six places. He contracted sugar diabetes, which affected his mind. Gangrene set in and his leg was removed. He died 8 years before I was born, so I never had the opportunity of meeting this remarkable Aboriginal patriot. As I said, the stories go that it was an accident, and I certainly think it was not an accident, and as the book tells that story. But it's an incredible story in that sense of what happened to him then at that time, because he wasn't in the public arena. Now, was it something to do with Aboriginal issues, him still being outspoken, or was it something to do with the working on the docks? I'll probably never find out, but I certainly have my own feelings. But for me, being descended from my grandfather just gives me such, and we find that here with all the descendants, incredible pride and courage and strength, and that's where you get everything that I've done and continue to do in my life, is the respect that I carry for his memory. And certainly all of those people, and the people from 38, and the people in the 50s and the 60s, they had incredible courage to stand up at that particular time period, their particular time periods. The reality is, in closing what I say, for me the legacy, I think that goes for the 30s group as well, the reality is the demands made then. My grandfather's demands in the 1920s, if it had been met in 1925 that enough land had been granted to each and every Aboriginal family in the country, we wouldn't be in the situation now of such horrific disadvantage economically for every Aboriginal family, basically, in the country, where we start behind the eight ball. If the demand had been met in 1925 that the Aborigines Protection Board stop the policy of taking Aboriginal kids from their families, we would not have had to endure another 5 decades of that horrific policy where thousands of Aboriginal kids were removed. If the demand to protect a distinct Aboriginal cultural identity had been met then, in 1925, we wouldn't be in the process of putting this jigsaw puzzle back together of our culture and of our language. If the demand had been met that the Protection Board was scrapped, we wouldn't have had to wait till 1967 referendum to get rid of it. And if a demand had been met that Aboriginal people themselves were the best place to take charge and direct Aboriginal affairs, we'd be in a far different place to go. Anyway, that's my talk, and thanks very much.
My name is Delphine Fraser. At the age of 6 months, I had Revoting in Gough Whitlam pamphlets in my purse, so very much political foundation. Secondly, oh, my God, thank you. As an Indigenous woman who politically driven, everything, the foundation of women and men standing in front of me is incredible, and it's to you and to your family, just even sitting here looking at you, hello. I'm a 1974 model. I was born in 1974 of April, and I find it a very interesting year. I've heard it mentioned a couple of times. It was a time where things were progressing, but also things were kind of stagnating. And to me, I lived for quite a time in Northern Territory, and there was a topic of synergy here. And I find it very interesting now with the NT invasion, not its intervention, it's an invasion, we'll be real about it. How are they going to record this? Honestly, and NT blackfellas need to put some form of foundation in, like you saw the mob, because in 20 years, what we are kind of suffering now, loss of language, loss of land, loss of that, they're going to be suffering. So my thing to me is a very much close watch on the NT invasion. And I'm sorry, I'm just so nervous. I'm just so excited to be here. I'm sorry. I think it's very important, and also just making things note, like living in NT, we'd have to go visit mob in the hospital. And one thing, when you go visit Northern Territory Hospital, you notice the blackfellas sitting all around the outside. To me, that's a deliberate act. To me, they turn the air conditions down so low, blackfellas can't bear it. And if you know blackfella, like Auntie said, she can't camp Canberra, she's too cold. They're climatised to their point, you know, and it's this recycling of things and not being real about it. Now, if they're real about it in NT Health, why don't they put an open hair hospital in there so mob can sit in there and aircon don't chill them? But I just wanted to make it those couple of notes. But the most note, oh my God, thank you. And can I please get your details on the left? I didn't get your name, I'm sorry, but I just would really like to be in contact with you, just with my studies, and also Mr. Maynard, if that's possible. And I know Tracy Bunder too, and ain't she deadly?
Comment on what Delphine just said. In Sydney, my mother was heavily involved just recently with a support group for the a group of women from Alice Springs, who were trying to speak out against the intervention because the media has been pretty much in control of a lot of the argument. And it was interesting. She had a lot of support from university students. I'm talking international and, you know, just regular Australian students. And I remember sitting there watching them all together one time, and Mum, I've not seen her. I've seen her passionate about a lot of things. But this one was one of the things that I hadn't seen in her for such a long time, and it dawned on me that it's because the whole intervention for her is just this nightmare of growing up on the missions all over again, you know, to have your income quarantined, you know, to be told where you can and can't go, and particularly the demonisation of men. You know, my brother and my son are Aboriginal men, you know, excuse me, but they're not molesters, they're not rapists. You know, there is no balance in this horrible story.
Delphine, you know, I talk a lot in a lot of different forums, and I speak up a lot about the NT stuff. And I love you calling it the invasion rather than the intervention, because that's precisely what it is. The point I always try to make is that what those mobs up there are experiencing now is what our mobs experienced here in the first 200 years. Mm. You know, and they are just as ill-equipped to deal with it. And they really need the help. So whatever level of help anyone can give there, I'm sure will be greatly appreciated. If you can speak up, speak up.
Mm. Well, we are disadvantaged as well. I mean, you touched on that. Certainly we've had a change of government, but where the media sits has not changed. I mean, and that is a big battle as far as we're concerned. Also, I mean, the apology was an incredible event, an extremely symbolic event as well. But from the government's position, we've had a lot of rhetoric at this point, and we've had decades of rhetoric. What we want is some action. I mean, as far as what's happening in the Northern Territory, Aboriginal people, Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal people at grassroots level have got to be involved in everything and have their say on anything that's done. This has been not part of the process of this. And, I mean, that's so important, I mean, that they need to take on board.
I hope that I can walk away meeting young Aboriginal educated people. I hope I can walk away from here this week. As I said, I'm 73 next month, and I'm sorry that I've never had this, you know, like you said, 1927, to ask for land. In 1938, they were asking for land. The government is never going to give us land. We are a commodity to white Australia. We are only 1.5% of the population, but without us, there are a hell of a lot of public servants out of a job. I'm sorry, you know. And what's the government going to do? If they get rid of all of us... I made a comment once, you know, down in Canberra many years ago, just give us $1 million each. Now, that's not going to do, you know, break you, but it'll help us. They're continually still giving us money. What for? Band-aid jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just don't have any illusions about this or where we're going to go as Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
And I hope, if I can talk to you young Aboriginal, it's up to us to do something. Yeah. Francis, get out there.
First of all, I want to congratulate all the speakers. It was just, you know, I never go to things, you know, really. So this is very rare for me to come out to go to anything because of you guys. What I want to say, first of all, is that the guy who introduced this afternoon, the session, talked about the chilli season, what is it? The fruit frozen thing.
The ice age.
And sure, there has been an ice age, and I think we all know that, and we're recovering from that, and we're sensing that. Also, I'd like to say, as a historian, and I see you all as historians, right? Some of us have done it at uni, some of us have done it in life. And the thing that I want to say about this, why did it take Fred Maynard's grandchild to write his history? Why does it take these three women to rectify and say who is in that photograph? Mm. Now, we have been talking as historians. We have always been referring to W.E.H. Stanner about the great Australian silence. Do not think for 1 minute that that's gone.
Mm. That's right.
And this last ice age is another example of that great Australian silence. Mm. It is an absolute indictment and a shame that grandchildren and people have to still be alive to record a necessary unknown history. Mm. We're still doing it. Mm. You know, and so many people out there think they know about Aboriginal history. Mm. Why are we still waiting for the grandchildren to write the stories? Mm. What's wrong? Mm. I don't care about proving to who. The white people of we like these women here have to provide evidence. Mm. This is native title. This is everything. This is terra nullius all over again. Mm. When it's left on the onus of black people to say, you know, we have to provide evidence of our existence. Mm. I'd like to see whites prove evidence of their being, you know, they're having rights to this land. But anyway, having said that, why I really wanted to speak was to congratulate, but also to say that I think Susie, Auntie Ollie and Auntie Esther here have been very, very generous and very dignified in not telling you the extent of what they face with the historian that refuses, downright refuses to acknowledge the people in the photograph. Mm. They have been very dignified in telling you the behaviour and the treatment. I have asked Susie, could I please be involved with watching the process happen to get this historian to acknowledge the women in these two ladies here in that photograph. It is a sham the way this white historian is being able to erase that history. And it's going to continue. So the great Australian silence is alive and well, and the ice age is still happening. And I just really want to say, it's not enough that we have to wait for the grandchildren to write the histories. They write the histories, but why aren't whites doing a better job?
Yeah. I don't think I'll give up my thermal underwear and my greatcoat yet, that's for sure.
Thank you. Thank you. You're an inspiration to certainly to me, and I've got friends here who similarly just are in awe of you, and we look up to you for your guidance, for your courage, and just like the lady earlier, I'm really nervous, but I want to say that there is a petition here that's, if people can sign it, it's to be presented to the Senate in regards to the concern for the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act in the Northern Territory, and if I can bring that down to the table, if people can please sign that before they leave today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and just like to say that I'm very glad I could come over and see my mother and my auntie out there. I am a great-great-granddaughter of William Cooper, and again, too, like Auntie Diana, Mum, I never knew till I was older. Then I'd tell yarns and stories and things, but we never put two and two together till school and other things came about. But in 1988, I went to Tramby and found my identity. March for the first time, and this year I was there for the celebration. I've been involved with the AECG for over 10 years, and I think when I went to Tramby, my mouth and attitudes of injustices, I was able to acknowledge that it is in my blood and that it's not going to stop. And this year, accidentally too, not on purpose, I ended up starting a Bachelor of Arts at university myself. So I will continue the fight and continue to educate my children on the struggles and fights, and that it will follow down my line. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to say, in answering that, when I went on to Cymru, our great-great-grandfather was such a famous man that he's still laid in an unmarked grave, and there'd been money collected and people had stole it, and then another collection and they didn't do it. There was three attempts. So within that 12 months that I was there, yes, our grandchildren put the headstone on his grave. And it didn't cost that much, like it was only $1,800. But now in the books where it says he lays in a unmarked grave, well, they need to correct it because he's now got a beautiful headstone.
Well, it's a similar story. I mean, Francis actually took me on the journey to find my grandfather's grave at Rookwood. And Francis filmed that for... We didn't put that in the documentary, but that was a very powerful moment for me, and I thank my sister there for that. And my grandfather, as again, is in an unmarked grave, and that will change as well. But, I mean, that was an incredible moment. Thanks, Francis, for that. Other questions?
Esther said earlier, you know, if you got rid of the blacks, it'd be all these bureaucrats out of a job. You know, well, if you got rid of the blacks, my opinion is not only would that be out of a job, but Australia wouldn't have an identity and it wouldn't have a soul because she's nicked that too.
I just wanted to say that July next year or August next year, the museum will be having an exhibition on the civil rights movement. We'll be talking about this period that's generally unknown, and we'll be celebrating the courage of these people. We basically from 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s talking about this and talking about some of this material we've been talking about today. And looking at those three objects there, you see the boomerang. It makes you think of the terrible loss that the stolen generation suffered, cultural loss. And you see that extraordinary picture of then known as the burning of the Humpy, and think of terror. And then you think of the thing in the middle is courage. And the courage, as you say, so many people have been saying, the courage of those people who work in those times is to be remembered. So I just thought that you know that we'll be having this exhibition, which we'll be celebrating again, these activists.
There's no more. I mean, I'd just like to say it's been an honour for me to share the stage with these strong, powerful Aboriginal women. And, I mean, it's certainly been a great afternoon, and I hope you've all enjoyed it in that respect, because there's been some great stuff. I mean, it's great to draw strength from that. And actually, we can take the courage, and other people can take the courage from our forebears in that sense. There's many Aboriginal people. It's not just the Coopers and the Maynards and the Pattons and the Ferguson and the whole host of people. It's important to say exactly what was said. About the people who are faceless and nameless in regards to this. Well, there were so many people over those decades who remained nameless, but we know they were there. It wasn't just about individuals, it was a movement. And that's such a thing we need to draw strength from today. We as Aboriginal people, we will not make change. We are on our own unless we are pulled together as a united group.
We remain a minority and we're heavily marginalised, and we need the support of non-Indigenous Australians as a part of that. Our people have always recognised that. They've seen the importance of it in their movements all the way through history, and that's what it's about today. So thanks very much.
The forum might want to sort of support the Ingram Carroll family here as saying that we acknowledge Indigenous knowledge of this photograph.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Francis, as always. and again, I want to thank...
Of course, John, there are any kind of disputes. If most people have had a chance. I mean, if you can see that those kids don't look alike, then please speak now. And, you know, I invite any kind of, you know,
yeah,
if
absolutely.
There's any... But, yeah, no, they are. It's really evident. Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's an important point, and we can take strength out of that in this regard. I mean, to finish off what's been a great afternoon. I want to just thank the museum again, and particularly Jay and Troy. And, I mean, I think we should all put our hands together for their input. And thanks very much for you people for coming along. It's been great having you, and it's been great to be a part of it. Thanks very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.